following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised.
From the Advocate magazine in partnership with GLAAD, this is LGBTQ&A. I'm Jeffrey Masters, and today I'm talking to Dr. Charles Silverstein, whose 1973 presentation before the American Psychiatric Association led them to declassify homosexuality as a mental illness. And you know, with how much has changed for our community since then, I think we can forget what a crucial game changer it was for the movement to have it officially declared that the way we live and love is not a mental illness. It is not something that needs or even can be cured. And this fight, everything that led up to it, including Charles's role in it, is a subject of a really fantastic new documentary called Cured that premieres on PBS on October 11th, if you want to check that out. And of course, like any movement in history, Charles wasn't acting alone. For many years, he was part of the Gay Activist Alliance, or the GAA. This was an early activist group that was founded about 6 months after the uprising at Stonewall. Charles was a part of their protests and zaps before eventually going on to co-write the 1977 landmark book, The Joy of Gay Sex. This book, along with being banned and burned, seized by custom agents around the world, this book really did educate generations of gay men about all aspects of gay life, sexual and not. So today we're talking about all of this with the now 86-year-old Dr. Charles Silverstein. Here he is. I want to start off by talking about your role in helping to declassify homosexuality as a mental disorder. But before we get to that, can you talk about why originally it was classified as that and any evidence or assumed facts that backed that up?
Well, everything about sexuality is based upon the moral beliefs of a society. And since homosexuality had been condemned as immoral, it just automatically was assumed that it should go into the diagnostic and statistical manual as a mental disorder. Everything that wasn't basically a heterosexual missionary position motivated by reproduction was considered abnormal. And homosexuality, since you invariably waste your seed, was considered ipso facto a disorder.
And so for you, when you were getting your PhD and, you know, being taught this, did you initially believe that?
I was very confused then. When I was getting my PhD, I was in the closet because I certainly was not going to let anyone in the program know that I was gay because that would get me thrown out. There was a period before I got to college where I wanted to change. And I went into therapy for the purpose of changing. Obviously, it didn't work, and it never works, but it was what most people did in those days.
I mean, now we refer to that as conversion therapy, but back then it was just considered therapy, right?
Yes.
If you were homosexual and in therapy, the only purpose was to be quote-unquote cured.
Yes, to change you into someone who was, quote, normal, meaning heterosexual. And that was my goal. All I accomplished is I had the opportunity of going to bed with some nice women who thought I was an appropriate match, but I wasn't.
Eventually you did, you know, make this presentation before the American Psychiatric Association.
Yes.
Was there a debate about who would make the presentation, or was it assumed that this was kind of your field and you would do it?
Since I was a psychologist, or at least working on my PhD in psychology. And it was decided that I should make the professional presentation, meaning the presentation for the research and clinical work that suggested that homosexuality was not a mental disorder. And then Jean O'Leary, who had been a nun, but was no longer a nun, she left the church, she would make the presentation from the point of view of ordinary people about discrimination in the city of New York. So it was a very well-organized presentation. We knew what everybody was going to do.
And because this was identified as a goal of the movement, it wasn't just like you guys thinking this would be good, like, on your own.
No, well, it had been started years before. Frank Kameny gets some of the credit for that. There are a number of psychiatrists who also were pushing to have homosexuality eliminated. Like every social movement, you always stand on the shoulders of the people who came before. Frank Kameny was not a part of this. Frank was a difficult person to get along with. Everyone who knew him would tell you that. He was a fierce fighter, but he could not have worked with us, and we wouldn't have had him helping us.
I think with like people like Frank Kameny, like Jim Obergefell, Amy Stevens most recently, you know, we connect historic events with people. Were you then connected with this? Like, was it your name? I guess what I'm asking is, like, did you feel like a celebrity in the gay community?
In some places, my name is connected with it. But I really do like to say these changes that occurred, not because of any one person at any one time, but it's really the sum total of a number of people who fought, sometimes against the enemy, sometimes with each other, because we had lots of that. There is no one person that can claim responsibility for these changes. We worked together. I was chosen to make this presentation because I knew the research, I knew the data, and I could present it well.
And so during this time, you were a member of the Gay Activist Alliance, the GAA, which was created in the wake of Stonewall.
Right.
I think it's an early gay organization that is important and yet not as well known. I just wonder if you can describe the group and what their goals were.
They were a radical organization. Let me contrast it with Frank Kameny. When Frank had demonstrations, everybody had to be a good boy and good girl. There was a dress code. Men had to wear suits, women dresses, shoes had to be shined. GAA was quite different. We weren't good boys, we were bad boys. And we wanted to be bad boys. And therefore, we were out there not dressed nicely, but dressed in ordinary clothes to make as much trouble as possible. What Frank and his group wanted to do was knock on the door of society and say, let us in. Oh, please let us in. What the radical movement in the early 70s did was not to say that we want to knock on the door. We wanted to fucking break it down and march through and tell society, we're changing you, you're going to change, and you better live with it. It was much more aggressive, but not violent. Aggressive, but not violent. And so what we did, we had these, what were called zaps. And the zap was a demonstration where we would go to an organization and we'd break it up. And we found that professional organizations are the biggest sissies around. I don't know, they called us sissies, but they were the real sissies. They didn't know how to deal with us. They would be having a meeting and some of our members would get up and say, we're taking over. And they would step to the side because they didn't know what to do. And that's why we kept winning everywhere we went.
You say that the members of the GAA were the strangest group of people you'd ever met. Why is that?
That was at the firehouse. You see, our center was the firehouse on Worcester Street. Because it was a place that we thought of as a place of liberation, that anyone could come in. You had to walk through the door. You didn't need a membership card. You didn't have to pay any dues. People who were oppressed could feel self-identified and walk in. Therefore, we had some lunatics that used to walk in through the door. And that's what I was talking about. We had some very strange people that came in. And they were all, no one was ever thrown out.
This was the firehouse that was four floors in Soho,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Who owned that building or like paid the rent?
I don't know who owned the building. It was called the firehouse because it was a firehouse. A real honest-to-go this firehouse, but no longer held the engines. It's not like there was a lot of fancy furniture. There were, I mean, the furniture were the rejects from the street. I don't know who laid out the money to get the place. It was then paid for through dues, not dues, but through our Saturday night dances, where people paid $2 to come to the dance and all the soda or beer that you want for the night. And through that, they paid the rent.
Because the group, I mean, was an activist organization, but it also had this like social component.
Yes.
For dances, for events.
Yes, it has a big social component. And that was really very important. You know, at the dances, there would be 1,000 guys there dancing.
In the firehouse?
Yeah.
Wow.
Easy, 1,000. The meetings, the general meetings, were like bedlam, would have 200 or 300 people there. And it was mostly a young crowd. But there were older people who were watching us and appreciative that we were there. But since they were older, they had more secure jobs that they had to worry about.
When you say younger, are you saying like teenagers or like 20s and 30s?
No. Late teens, 20s, early 30s.
Oh, and so to your point, the older people had established jobs and it couldn't be found out that they were gay.
Right, that had to be afraid of. And so, for instance, sometimes photographers would come in to take pictures of us, and it would be announced that the photographer is going to be wherever. If you don't want your picture taken, come and stand on the other side.
So it's a really big emphasis on discretion.
Right. One of the primary problems about being gay in those days was a sense of loneliness and isolation. You could go to the baths and have sex with a guy, not know his name. You could go over to Central Park here and go to the bridal path and give or get a blowjob. Or you could go downtown to the trucks, do the same thing. But there wasn't a sense of affiliation between people. What GAA did was allowed gay men primarily to get to know each other in a setting other than just sex. You got to know each other as people. You got to know each other's names. You might visit each other during the week. Now, it may seem strange today, but in those days, we didn't do that.
I've never heard anybody articulate it like that before. So, like, when I moved to New York City a couple of years ago, I was like, okay, where are my gay friends? And you're saying that during those days in the early 70s, that there was no conception of that. It was just kind of like one-off experiences, not a community of people.
It was like Boys in the Band, that group of self-hating gay men who were very jealous of each other and who were very sad. With GAA, and there were similar organizations in other cities as well, you got to know people as people. You laughed together, you went on zaps together, cursing the police or the city council or whoever you wanted to curse. And you had that sense of camaraderie.
Wow.
One day, at the end of a dance, we had a demonstration. We walked from the firehouse over to the building of a councilman who was holding up a civil rights bill. There's 1,000 guys walking up the street and over to his building to shout as loud as we can at 2 o'clock in the morning and wake everybody up. That was our goal. In fact, he wasn't in his apartment. We knew he wasn't. Didn't make any difference. The point is was to have this demonstration, have the police show up, have the reporters and cameramen show up, and make a big simus out of it.
Wait, what?
Big simus. A big deal. I thought you said you're Jewish.
No, I am. I was clarifying what you said.
We were like an organism in the street, marching up with a sense of camaraderie and friendship with each other. That sort of thing was different than what had come before.
That kind of reminds me of something you wrote about in your book, For the Ferryman, about how during the earliest Pride marches, you would walk up to people and you greeted them by saying, "Happy birthday." You said it was as if you'd all been reborn and this was now your birthday. And I just had never heard that detail before.
Oh, yeah. We all did that. We did that every year. Not only that, but at the firehouse, at the Saturday night dances, there would be an officer at the door. And when the person would come in, the officer would be there to say welcome and shake his hand. But you see, things like that were very important. They were meant to fight the isolation we experienced in those days. I mean, for instance, when I walked through those doors the first time and someone came over to me and shook my hand and said, welcome, I was shocked. You know, the gay person in those days wanted to hide here, coming over and talking to me.
And then in June, you would say happy birthday to greet each other.
Yes, we would shake each other's hand and say happy birthday. That changed when it became a parade. When it changed from a march to a parade, the whole ideology changed. We would walk up Fifth Avenue to Central Park. And in Central Park, we had what was called a gay-in, lying down on the grass, and you know, people would be making out. There were some speeches that were being made that no one listened to. But then when it changed so that it began on Central Park West and marched downtown, and there was the sale of beer and all the rest of that, the whole temper changed.
Hearing you say all this, it makes sense to me that when you went on to then co-author The Joy of Gay Sex with Edmund White, it makes sense that that book, yes, is about sex, but it's also about community, how to find and build queer community in a non-sexual aspect. It's there, you know, on every page.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when Ed and I first sat down to talk about the book, and we made a list of the entries, it was quite clear that a majority of the entries were not about sex. It was about community. And it was about relating to each other. While most people, you know, think of all the dirty pictures, what we always thought our greatest contribution was is trying to write something that we would have wanted when we were kids. And that would be something more than just sex. That would be about community.
I was so surprised by the use of the word fucking as a verb. Can you talk about the decision to use that word instead of any euphemisms or just anything else?
As a matter of fact, the publisher of Crown's name went on it here. He called me in. He said, why do you have to use the word cock? He didn't say fuck. He said cock. As if I didn't know what he meant. I asked him, what word you want me to use? And he said, well, can't you use penis? And I said to him, your cock is different than your penis. He said, what's the difference? He said, well, your penis is a part of your anatomy, and your cock is what you fuck your wife with. Cock stayed in. Interesting enough, fuck was not objected to, but the word shit was. See, there were sets of lawyers on both sides of the Atlantic reading all the things we had written. And so he had lawyers there and here, and anyone could raise an objection, and often did.
Was that the case in the later revised editions as well?
In the later editions, there were no problems of censorship at all.
And in those later editions, you added in sections about safe sex and HIV. This was the 90s. This book and the subsequent editions really educated generations of gay men. But for you, there was no book like this. Where did you learn all this when you were coming of age?
I would say I learned it on the job.
So trial and error.
Yeah, with lots of errors. In those days, there simply wasn't much around. You just had to learn. I remember the first time I had sex with a guy, and it was a big learning experience. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Fortunately, he did.
Well, you also label that first sexual experience as the, you know, catalyst for your entire life of work.
Yes.
You know, you decided at that moment to fight for acceptance. What was it about having sex for the first time that made that spark?
Because he was such a nice guy. See, I had come to this with a sense of shame that I was bad. That's why I went into psychoanalysis for years. And here I met someone who was completely different, who seemed to like me and who certainly liked his life. And I'd never met someone like that before because I never allowed myself to. And that changed things. There was this enormous amount of pent-up energy.
Yeah.
And the guy is waiting to just explode. So exciting.
You know, today, open relationships and non-monogamy seems to be more prevalent than ever. Is that true, or are more people simply just talking about it more than ever before?
Well, it's an interesting question you ask. We certainly have more relationships that are considered to be open relationships. We have more polyandry. In days gone by, you had less of them openly. But whether they existed anyway is an interesting question, and I don't think any of us have the answer. In other words, today, what they are, they certainly are more honest, whereas back in my day, 100 years ago, people would lie. Now, you know, to what extent these relationships survive, I don't know.
So while I'm asking questions that maybe don't have an answer, I have one more.
Go ahead.
Which is that in your book, Man to Man, you have a chapter called Fathers, Sons, and Lovers.
Yes.
About the father's importance in one's sexual development. Is it wrong for me to connect that to the prevalence of the word daddy now in today's culture?
You know, there is a whole daddy scene in gay culture. Not sure how large it is, but there's certainly a daddy scene, and always has been.
So this is not new.
It is not new. There was even such a magazine called Daddy Magazine. I have a couple of old copies here somewhere.
Because it's now used kind of like we use like bears, otters. Daddy is now part of that.
Yes. Yes.
I guess I think that like we make so many jokes about daddies like nowadays, and I wonder like what is the underlying like reason why that has like a connection to gay men specifically?
I think some of it has to do with issues of masculinity, and daddy is more masculine. Some of it has to do with power issues. You know, one of the things that's true in certainly gay male relationships is that when two guys have sex, there is a power relationship between them. But it's a voluntary one. You know, we talk about tops and bottoms. And there's a power relationship there. Now, some would argue that it's the bottoms that have the real power. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. But society in general doesn't look at it that way, because it more matches heterosexual sex.
Now that you're 86 years old, how has your own relationship to sex changed?
Well, when you get to be 86, you don't have a lot of sex, which is all right. I mean, there is something about testosterone levels going down. That's not the only thing that goes down. Gravity will take its will on you. I'm still sexually interested, but I have less opportunity. And of course, to tell you the truth, I don't really want to date anyone. I don't want to go through that. Been there, done that.
Regarding dating, in your memoir, you write about, you know, your great love of over 20 years, William.
Yes, yes.
I only bring him up now because the name on the screen for your computer says William on the Zoom.
Oh, I see. It's a password.
Oh, that's your password.
That's a password.
Sorry, I just...
That's a password.
Oh, a password.
I have 12,000 passwords.
Oh, gotcha.
My passwords have passwords. I can't keep up with them. But if you're asking me, do I think about him, I would say every day. I don't stop loving him because he's dead.
Yeah.
Just miss him.
And so losing him, is that why you say you have no interest in going through that again?
No, it's because of how much work is involved. I have close relationships, and I'd love to have a close relationship with another person, sure. But I wouldn't want to go through all the drama that one goes through to have a lover, husband, whatever.
I mean, last question about your sex life, but sex was such a big part of your life and your adulthood for so long. Now that you do have it less frequently, is that, do you feel like a part of you is missing, or is it just that's like what happens and that's life?
Both of them, actually. I miss some of that. But also, there's a lot of disappointment that goes along with it, and it's a lot of pain. I can do without that. You know, I found that the more in love two people are, the more easily it is for them to hurt each other. So if I have any kind of other relationship, I don't want it to be that hurtful. Now, I have a number of very good friends, very close friends, and we take care of each other. I know that if I need something, I know all the people I can call on, and they know they can call on me. Would I like something more? Yeah. But what I would like is not what you expect.
What is that?
What I would have liked is when I was younger, would have been the opportunity of having children. Something that some days are possible today. But I would have liked to have kids. I've worked a lot of my life with kids. Read summer camps and the Boy Scouts. I like kids. That's what I regret more than anything else. You didn't expect that one, did you?
I feel like it's like, I have like, it's like a simple question, but like, what was stopping you from having kids?
It was legally impossible in those days.
Oh.
You didn't know that? You give a child to fags? That didn't happen in those days.
So it was not even a discussion?
It was not even a discussion. Today, gay people can adopt children. Sometimes you make arrangements, have a female friend making love to a turkey baster, that sort of thing. But in those days, it really was unthinkable. Remember, sex was still against the law. The sodomy prohibition didn't come down to, I remember, it was the Virginia case that finally went to the Supreme Court. But before then, it was against the law. Having sex was against the law. They were very restrictive years. Now, I'm glad that younger generations are more free. That's what we were fighting for.
I mean, intellectually, like, it's easy to acknowledge how different things were back then. And yet, I still find myself being taken aback with each new detail that I learn. So I really do appreciate you being here and for the fantastic conversation.
But no, I'm glad I was helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was Dr. Charles Silverstein. You can learn more about him and his work in the new documentary coming out. That's called Cured, and it airs on PBS on October 11th. And then if you want to hear more about these early struggles for queer and trans rights, I recently got to speak to Miss Major Griffin Gracie, who is a legendary elder in the trans community.
Nobody understands it to whereby a girl can get to this age. I do good to be here. Most girls don't make it past 30.
That full interview with Miss Major is in our podcast feed from February, so scroll all the way up, or you can click the link in our show notes. Special thanks this week to Richie Jackson. Richie is the author of the very good book called Gay Like Me, and he let me borrow his copy of The Joy of Gay Sex to prepare for this interview. You know, passing this book from gay hand to gay hand is a great gay tradition, so we were very happy to be able to continue that. We're brought to you by The Advocate magazine in partnership with GLAAD. I'm Jeffrey Masters. I'll see you next week with a member of the U.S. Senate. See you then. Bye.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal. McGill University's 4th annual Queer History Month is taking place this October.
The featured keynote presentation is taking place from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on Friday, October 1st, with entomologist Jessica Ware of Rutgers University. Join in later in the month for more exciting programming, including a chat with an elder session from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th, a zine-making workshop on Thursday, October 21st from noon to 2 p.m., a trans and non-binary in academia panel discussion on Wednesday, October 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., and finally, a queer open mic night with performances by Opera Queens on Thursday, October 28th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. Visit the Equity at McGill webpages, www.mcgill.ca/equity, for a complete list of Queer History Month events organized by McGill's Office of the Provost and Vice Principal Academic and their partners. Queer History Month will be opened and closed by Elder Gawenodas Sedalio Fazio. The goal of McGill's Queer History Month is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
Miss Major Griffin Gracie is a singular force in our community. She's a veteran of the Stonewall Uprising and has spent the 50 years since working and advocating for incarcerated trans folks, particularly trans women of color, who, like Miss Major was, are often housed in men's prisons. Major moved to New York City in the 60s, and when I think about the other trans women from that era, people we now consider to be legends, like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, they weren't spoken about or celebrated in their lifetimes the way that they are today. So with Miss Major, who I also put in that category, I think we have an opportunity and an obligation to give her her flowers now, to celebrate her work and achievements right in front of her face. And as you're gonna hear today, Miss Major still has a great amount of wisdom left to impart. Today, Miss Major lives in Arkansas and is one of the executive producers of Trans in Trumpland. That's a new docuseries that premieres this week and is available on streaming services like Topic and Amazon Prime. From The Advocate magazine in partnership with GLAAD, I'm Jeffrey Masters, and this is LGBTQ&A. I know that you had a stroke about a year and a half ago. How are you doing now?
I'm doing really well. I have to speak a little bit slower now. I have a problem getting around, but basically I'm doing okay. Thank God for medicine.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Thank you.
Now, I want to go back to your early years for a moment. Growing up, you didn't have words like transgender. That wasn't anything in the public consciousness in any mainstream way. So early on, when it came to your femininity, how are you thinking about it? How are you interpreting those feelings?
You know, at the time, we weren't sure what we were. I did feel odd with my body, and dresses did feel comfortable. That's what it was. All of a sudden, dresses were important to me, and they were a lot easier to wear than pants.
And then you were 22, I believe, when you moved to New York City.
Yes.
How did you find trans community when you got there?
Are you kidding? Trans community was everywhere.
Really?
At the time, I went immediately to 42nd Street. Everybody went to 42nd Street. Trans girls, everybody. So meeting them was not a problem. They were everywhere. And then from there, I found an apartment and moved into that, and it was six floors of nothing but girls. It was fabulous.
All trans girls.
Yeah, everyone in the building. A certain comfort came with that. That kept me going. It was a full life, you know. You could have fun, and it was good being around people I felt connected to. I developed good friendships and stuff like that. Yeah, I felt a part of the world.
And some of the people that you knew back then were famous names that we know now, like Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, Crystal LaBeija. I know that you worked with Stormy DeLavier. Is it weird to look back and see that so many of these women that you knew have now gained icon status?
No, because they're just friends to me. They're not icons, you know. I don't know where that term came from, how we got stamped with it. You know, they're just friends. Even though it's happening and it's happened to me, you really don't pay attention to when it started. All of a sudden, it's, oh my God, there's this major, you know. Who, what, where, you know? Oh, me.
Well, I think that unlike those women, you have lived long enough to be celebrated in your lifetime. Do you feel like your work is acknowledged?
I do, in a sense of the community I'm from acknowledges me. The gay community doesn't. That's rather hurtful. They remember Sylvia and Marcia loudly, and they forget about people who were incidental in that stuff, you know. But that's fine. You know, you get used to that. It happens. Just go on and do what you have to do. Keep going forward.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Well, you know, it has to do with the time. A lot of people don't take the time to find out what started, whatever happened, what was the importance of it. And they pick people in that they will admire. The fact that they admire those two, good. I'm glad that they do. They don't have to know all of us.
And back in the 60s, you know, before Stonewall occurred, were you involved in activism then?
I was involved with it when my friend died, Puppy. She was murdered in her apartment by some man. We knew at the time in the community that someone who knew her had murdered her. And the police did not care. It didn't matter to them at all. And that was hurtful to us. And so that started my activism. Then I wanted to know what cars people were getting in, what the person looked like who they got in with, when they left and when they came back was important. And all of us started keeping notes up when it was to keep up with the John, because we didn't know what would happen to us then.
And so back then, in order to keep yourself safe while you are doing sex work, were you learning by trial and error, or did somebody help you, teach you, or like mentor you in that way?
You know, it was both. You learn things different than what someone told you. You know, you learn by trial and error, and you paid attention to what the girls tell you, because you don't know it all. Nobody does.
And you've actually said that you loved doing it. You loved being a sex worker. What did you like about it?
The number of guys. The money, especially the money. You know, I went into this because it was fun. Other girls went into it for survival, to make it, you know. And I was lucky that I always worked. I got a job in social services at first. And extra money from the John.
So with the apartment building that you were living in, the six floors of trans women, if you can like estimate, like what percentage of them were also doing sex work?
All those, the whole building. One or two might not have been doing that, but all of us were. We had different hours, you know, than somebody else. But all of us partook of that certain activity. Yeah.
And I guess what I'm getting at is like back then, there were very few options for employment.
There were none, really. You had to get a job in your male persona and hopefully work at that. That was all that we had. The entire building, except for maybe two people, would have to do that. It was hard, but I guess being around people who thought like you did made it seem possible. It made it worthwhile.
And so I mentioned Stonewall a little bit ago, and you were there the night of the uprising.
Yeah.
50 years later, what stands out in your memory of that night the most?
Well, I got knocked out early in it because I heard from the girls that you need to piss those guys off so that the police would knock you out and then you didn't get hurt. And so I was concerned with getting hurt, getting something broken or being bashed, you know, where I could not work no more, you know. So I spit in some guy's face and he knocked me out. That I remember. Other than that, I remember nothing.
So I've always heard that you were knocked out that night. I never knew that it was a decision that you made
that
it would be safer to be knocked out.
Oh, yeah. It was a decision because it was safer. It was safer. And it would have been if I stood and fought them. No, I'm not doing that. I was young and I was pretty and I wanted to keep my face. So,
I mean, there were so many laws against cross-dressing at that time. Were you like presenting as a woman that night?
Yes. Oh, yes. Always. Please, child. But you had to have 3 articles of men's clothing on to let somebody know that you were a man. I wore a t-shirt under my blouse. I had an earring at the time that said, I'm a man.
What was the 3rd piece of clothing?
It was a pair of underwear.
Okay, it's a little bit harder to see.
Yeah. But that's what it was.
And so that was 1969. So much has changed since then for trans people, and so much still needs to change. But on an individual level, what has changed in your life?
Well, my life is better in general. I can shop. I can go about my day in whatever time I please, you know, that has changed a lot. What hasn't changed is 1 or 2 people have an attitude about me, you know. But with the way things have turned out, I don't care. They don't like me. Oh, well. And I'm going about my business. That's important.
You know, a consistent aspect of your life seems to be that you've always been this mother figure. You have kids, biological and chosen. Was it always important to you to be a mother?
No, in the beginning, I never thought I would be. But as time has evolved, that's a very sweet thing that they've done. Because when they asked me to do that, it means something to me that they've asked me.
When they ask you to be their mother?
Their mother, yeah. What'd you say, no? To something like that, you know. It makes me feel good that they trust me enough to do that. I try to make sure that I don't let them down.
How many people call you mother?
Are you kidding? I can't count. I don't know.
Give me an estimate, like 20, 60?
An estimate, okay, of 100 people say to do me, 99 call me mother.
Okay, so I was a bit off.
Yeah. It's a large number, but that's what it is.
Well, when people talk about you, it also seems like you are a mother in action and practice. You reach out to people with, you know, phone calls and messages.
Yeah, I do.
You take it seriously.
Very seriously. Because it's important to acknowledge it and to respond, to be there when they need you. And the best way to do that is to call and see what's happening, find out how they're doing, what's happening in their lives, not just mine.
I think what stands out and is heartbreaking to me is that while you have mothered many, your own parents really struggled with your gender. Is it too simple to draw a line from, you know, what was missing from your own parents to like what you do now for other people?
No, because my parents have to go through whatever they do. Their position that they took upon me was their position. There's nothing I can do about that, you know. But I can do that when someone comes to me. I think the thing is that parents, when they're given a male or a female at birth, they expect that person to grow up and stay in that thing. And they're entitled to that. If they can learn from it and gradually change with you, good. If they can't, also good. You can't force this on them.
Did your parents ever come around?
Oh, my mother died waiting for me to change. My father lived about 10 years after mother died. He came around. He wouldn't call me she, but he acknowledged that Miss Mater did exist. So what more could I ask?
our language for gender has really evolved, especially in your lifetime. You know, we've had words like crossdresser and transvestite, transsexual. We've used words like pre-op and post-op. Did you identify as each of these things at one point or another?
Every now and then, I listen to it and tell myself, no, I'm not in that. No, not at all.
But it seems like you finally settled on transgender and use that for yourself, though.
I use that now. Before, I considered myself a man that liked to wear dresses. That's all. And now it's like, okay, well, I'll be transgender since it's a popular term.
Were you identifying as a woman and using this language when you were incarcerated? I'm wondering if there was ever any discussion about housing you in the women's prison.
No, there was never any. I went straight to the men, and that was fine. Because when I got there, I let them know I'm a woman, and then I got locked up. And it was fine, you know. No one wanted to beat me up. Of course, I'm 6'2", and 250 pounds, so don't fuck with me. Basically, it was nice. It was nice.
What was nice, specifically?
It was like being in New York City on 42nd Street. You had some freedom to move around. There were a couple of girls in prison with me.
Even in prison, you had other trans women there?
Yeah. Oh, sure. There were. In every prison I went to, yeah, there were some there.
And while you were incarcerated, you really credit that with where you learned about prison abolition and how it affects the trans community specifically.
It was in Dannemora. There was a prison and mental institution. And they put me in the mental institution first. And that was hard because they stripped me down in front of everybody and made me walk the places that I had to go naked. I became aware of what was going on. And then they had the Ethical Riots. And they brought some of those guys and put them in the same cell block I was in, the hole. I got to talk to them and learn everybody suffered in there, you know, to not take it on as if I was the only one that had happened. It happened to all of us. I then realized what I had to do. I have to do something to keep the girls safe in there.
And you did this work for many years with the Transgender, Gender Variant, and Intersex Justice Project, the TGIJP. Now you're one of the executive producers of the new docuseries called Trans in Trumpland. What made you want to be a part of that series?
Because the people need to know that this country is what's fucked up. Not just him, you know. He got in because of that. And that something's wrong with that, you know.
I think the series obviously delves into these very serious issues, but I also think it's nice that it shows that you can be trans and not live in a big, major metropolitan city.
Yes. And that's changed. Like, I'm in Arkansas now. I never thought about coming to Arkansas. You figure I'm Black, I'm male, I'm female, you know. And Arkansas, no, never. But now I can move here. And it's been nice here. Quiet, unobtrusive. I go about my day and they don't bother me as much as they would have in a large city. It's amazing the change that's happened.
The change in the world or the change in your life?
The world in general. I was traveling before this pandemic hit. Everywhere I went, I was accepted. I didn't have to hide. It's changed.
Well, the world has changed, but I'm also curious about your own experience of gender. Has that evolved over your life as well?
You know, it's an everyday thing. You become confident in stuff every day. You become more secure in your standing as who you are. And it has an effect on you when things change outside your purview. You feel you belong. It's not just that we're alone in a dark in the back. We're standing forward now. Sometimes the light is on us, you know. And that's a good thing.
I've seen you rock, you know, a stubble and a gorgeous wig, and I didn't know if you'd always feel comfortable doing that.
Oh, yeah, honey. I am who I am, you know, and I feel feminine. And the masculine things don't affect me, but I do good to be here. Most girls don't make it past 30. It's a rough life that we have, and nobody understands it to whereby a girl can get to this age, you know.
I mean, do you have any friends that are your age that are trans?
Not that many. That's few and far between. I don't know any that I can recall at all. The girl who lived in the building, there's maybe one still alive. Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard when you think about it.
You've also lost just a lot of people in your life, from friends and family and partners. With everything that we're talking about, has that changed how you think about your own death?
You know, I don't think about it. Once in a while, I do. When my son was born, the oldest one, and now this new one, I would want to be here for his getting older, you know, and get to know him like I have my other sons, you know. I don't think about it because it's an inevitable thing. We all have to get there sometime. I figure, well, why worry about it? It comes when it does. Yeah.
What are the big things you still want to do?
I want to start traveling again. I want to go places. Get to know the girls that are out there. Let them see that they can touch me. I'm alive. There aren't that many Black girls still alive to come this far. So we got to be there for everybody. Let them know that they can get here too.
Last question before I let you go, but, you know, 50, 60 years ago, while you were living in New York City, if someone had told you that you would become one of the most celebrated trans elders alive, what would you have said to that?
I'd have said they're kidding and went on with my business. It would not have happened. No, no way.
Thank you for spending so much time with us today.
Of course, it's nice talking to you.
And that's Miss Major Griffin Gracie. Now, again, if you want to see the docuseries that she's the executive producer of, that's called Trans in Trumpland and is available on streaming services like Amazon Prime or Topic. Now, if you enjoyed this interview, please take a second to leave a comment for us on Apple Podcasts. Doing things like that really does make a big difference, just like tweeting about us or posting about us on social media. So thank you so much to everyone who does that. And if you do, make sure you tag us. We're on Twitter and Instagram at LGBTQpod. I'm on there at JeffMasters1. We're brought to you by The Advocate Magazine in partnership with GLAAD. And then next week, we will be back with Jim Obergefell, who you know from the famous Supreme Court case Obergefell v. Hodges that made marriage equality legal. So that is this Tuesday. I'll see you right back here. Bye.
Sam's excited to see his favorite band play live. He's thought about it all week. He bought his ticket. He wore his band t-shirt. He went to the concert venue. He wasn't allowed inside the concert venue. He put away his band t-shirt. He threw away his ticket. And he thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. Beginning in September, you'll need a vaccination passport to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
écoutez Lesbosson avec Nathalie Di Palma. Sur les ondes de CKUT, le 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir. Notre invité Claude Perrière, alias Claude Lanthrope, est une artiste queer montréalaise. Adolescente, sa carrière débute en chanson, en remportant plusieurs prix dans des concours de chansons de la Nozière et en chantant dans les cabarets de Montréal. Elle s'est fait découvrir en étant finaliste du concours Ma première place des arts en 2010 et en faisant partie du groupe Les Sophilanthropes de 2010 à 2015. Elle complète par la suite un baccalauréat en musique numérique et depuis, elle n'a jamais cessé de créer. Bonsoir Claude Lanthrope.
Allô?
La musique et le désir de la partager en faisant des spectacles est arrivé tôt dans ta vie? De quelle manière ça a commencé?
Bien, j'ai commencé au secondaire. J'étais dans une école secondaire où on avait la chance de pouvoir faire de la musique le midi dans un local. Puis, on pouvait faire des shows dans la chapelle. Donc, assez tôt, je prenais des cours de piano classique déjà à cette époque-là. Donc, dès que j'ai eu l'opportunité au secondaire de me joindre à la gang de musiciens et de musiciens, je me suis joint, puis là, on faisait des shows peut-être une fois par mois ou deux mois dans la chapelle. Puis déjà à cet âge-là, j'ai commencé à composer mes propres chansons, puis on les arrangeait avec les musiciens à l'école. J'en ai présenté quelques-unes là, déjà au secondaire.
Tu viens de quelle région de la Nozière?